Today, healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations with Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between, offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
I'm Jason Pack, and this is Disorder, a show where we usually talk about, you know, small things like the role of the United States in ordering the world, how we can work together to prevent climate change. And this week, we're going to talk about even smaller, simpler topics like the nature of randomness in our daily lives, whether or not events and decisions that our ancestors made decades or generations ago affects what we do now. And it's been exactly 6 months to the day since the Disorder podcast launched. We're honored to be rejoined by our very first guest from episode one, the man himself who inspired me to launch this podcast, Brian Kloss. And we're gonna get to delve into the philosophical ideas that underpinned Brian's new book, Fluke. So, Brian, very briefly put, is an oversimplification of the thesis of your book that our lives, our careers, our romantic relationships, our monetary fortunes, our offsprings, they all derive from a series of seen and unseen coincidences or flukes that happen behind the scenes and affect why you were born rather than someone else, why I studied Middle East instead of China. Is that right? Is that what a fluke is?
Yeah, I mean, the book's thesis is basically arguing that the world exists partway between order and disorder. And the disorder is captured, I think, best by chaos theory, which basically shows that small changes, sometimes arbitrary changes, can have profound and earth-shattering consequences. And so the book is taking seriously this idea that the mantra that so many smart thinkers, quote-unquote smart thinkers, say to focus on the signal and ignore the noise is actually quite bad advice, because a lot of the noise is what produces the most consequential events in our societies and in our lives. So it's trying to apply chaos theory to humans, effectively.
Yes, and there's so much chaos around us that it seems quite obvious that the noise of Ambassador Stevens being killed on September 12th, 2012, seemed like not a major top-table event, one or two Americans or four Americans getting killed, and it was incredibly important to getting Donald Trump elected. Maybe there is no such thing as signal versus noise?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a question about like what's true and what's useful. I think what's true is that there is no such thing as noise. That literally, when we think about cause and effect relationships in politics, in our lives, whatever it is, the causality is an infinite number of things. They have to be exactly as they were for that exact event to happen in exactly that way. The argument that comes through with the signal and the noise is like, okay, yes, but that's not useful. Because if you have an infinite number of variables, you can't understand a system in a sort of more straightforward way. And so what I think is a problem is that we've often lost sight of what's true. We pretend the models are actually the world. And so to my mind, yes, it's absolutely the case that there is no such thing as noise. When we're trying to model the world or trying to predict change, we sometimes use this crutch of signal versus noise. I'm arguing that basically it leads us astray. It creates a world in which we think there's an illusion of order on the day-to-day, and therefore everything seems fine, whereas like the underlying systems are rapidly changing, and you have, you know, 25 years in the 21st century of just black swan events that have defined most geopolitical structures since, you know, September 11th, 2001.
I think that's a great insight, and it articulated a lot of what the disorder program is about, right? I am trying to put forward my emotional truth, because I can't prove it, that something changed in geopolitics somewhere between 1999 and 2003 and 2011. And like you said, we're having a rapid succession of many black swan events. I postulate that this has to do with a range of factors, from America's role in the world to the interconnectedness of our financial systems to the inability of allies to coordinate to misinformation, whatever. But maybe you're onto something, which is that it has to do with the dominance of these fake modelings of the world, and that people trying to run these hyper-efficient models and misunderstand things.
I think the issue is that we're getting better and better at the modeling, so it's easier and easier to think that it's the real world. George Box, the mathematician, has this line where he says, all models are wrong, some are useful. You know, I think sometimes we lose sight of that, because with things like AI and machine learning, or things like, you know, supercomputers and extremely precise data and so on, we're getting better and better at matching mathematical models to like what happened in the past. At exactly the same time that the underlying cause and effect relationships are more fluid than they ever have been before, right? So in economics, there's this concept called non-stationarity. There's a sort of question with non-stationarity. It's like, what if the cause and effect relationship that you're studying is moving as you're studying it, right? It's changing as you study.
Ooh, it's like a Heisenberg uncertainty thing of the cause and effect relationship.
Well, so the one that I think illustrates this principle in a sort of mind-bending way for social scientists to contemplate that's more in your world is the Arab Spring, because there's this whole literature before the Arab Spring that says authoritarian regimes in the Middle East are durable, right? And here's why they're durable, and here's our model that explains their durability. And then all of a sudden, of course, you know, late 2010, a guy lights himself on fire in central Tunisia. All these regimes collapse. Some of them go into war. Some of them have uprisings and so on. And the immediate reaction to that in the scholarly community was like, we have falsified the authoritarian durability hypothesis, right? But so that's option one. Option one is the theory was wrong. Option two is that the world changed. And both of those are possible, and they would appeal.
I believe it's probably a combination of both, but more the latter.
Yeah, but this is the kind of stuff where I think what actually happens is when we have a way of understanding geopolitics and then something challenges that dominant paradigm, what we tend to do is say, oh, they were wrong. But the thing is, the world is constantly changing. So today is literally different from yesterday in causal dynamics. Now, it might be a small amount, but like we all saw this in the pandemic. Like, it was totally obvious to us that the causal dynamics of the world changed a lot in 1 month in 2020. But that's happening constantly. It's just not so abrupt. So the question is, like, when we try to theorize about what's going on in the world, we're dealing with a moving target. And I think most of the people who are trying to make sense of geopolitics treat it as though it's a stationary target. And so they are ever increasingly, you know, turning to new models and new data and so on, with this false assumption underlying everything that the patterns that we're trying to discern are actually static. That's one of the things that I'm taking aim at in terms of the sort of modeling view of the world, that actually part of the disorder isn't that we've misdiagnosed things, it's that the world is changing every single day. And our systems, our study of it, and our institutions are relatively static, and that creates problems as well.
I feel like it might be useful to explain for our listeners what really is complexity science, tipping points, feedback loops, flukes. Why are these things important for people who are not in our line of work and just want to make sure that crazy authoritarians are not dominating their lives?
Yeah, so I think when most people think about history, they think about it from one of two frameworks. One is where sort of, you know, there's sort of the great man theory of history. Big influential people drive the engine of history and so on. And then there's the polar opposite of that, which is the trends. And it's sort of these long-term cycles or long-term things that add up over time. The reason why complexity science is a better way of thinking about this in my mind is because it takes seriously the idea of things like tipping points and what are called nonlinear dynamics. So it's jargony to say linear dynamics, but what we actually mean there is that the size of an effect is proportionate to the size of its cause. So if something big in the world happens, it must have a big cause.
It's obviously not true.
Wait, we know that's not true, right? I mean, there's huge, like the World War I gets triggered by an assassination in Sarajevo. You have the pandemic getting triggered by a single mutation of one virus infecting one person in China. So it's obviously the case that you can have really profound consequences from tiny perturbations in a system. What people don't understand is that almost every model that is used to make sense of the world is a linear model. almost all the quantitative modeling that exists in the last sort of 3 or 4 decades in social science, most of it is linear regressions. So the idea of complexity science is thinking seriously about how systems might interact in ways that are different from their component parts. You try to always understand the component parts. You always try to understand what's going on in the system. But they said, let's look at the system as a whole. Let's look at the economy as a whole. And you've got 8 billion people in the global economy. We need to take that seriously. We can't just have this regression with 4 or 5 variables to explain everything, right? And a tipping point is this idea that a system can develop fragility or it can develop the risk of a cascade at a crucial moment. So I write about in the book this idea that there's like a sand pile model, right? So the sand pile is this thing in physics where you add a grain of sand over and over and over into a pile. Eventually the pile gets so tall that one additional grain of sand will cause the avalanche, right?
So there literally is a straw that can break a camel's back. Although it's incredibly difficult for us to understand, we actually experience these tipping points all the time.
Yes. And so the question, you know, for like, if you're trying to understand the rise of Trump, like, obviously, it's the case that there needed to be stress in the system. There needed to be anti-immigrant sentiment. There needed to be disaffection with the elites and so on. But you also needed Trump. And you also needed Clinton to be the kind of candidate that she was. And you also needed Comey to end up releasing his FBI report right before the election where he reopened the investigation. And like, all these things are important. And if one of them had fallen out of place, like, it's totally possible that he might not have won. So it's thinking about social systems as partway between chaos and order. That's the right way to do it, basically.
You and I can both believe in data and modeling and cause and effect and rules and systems, but we can be modest enough to think that the world is so complex, we are not going to be immodest to think that we can map all of these variables in time to come out with solutions, and that maybe embracing the enduring disorder and understanding that we don't have the tools to grasp all these things, you can't try to get to the answer based on data.
So, like, the way I think about this is that hubris is tied to the illusion of control. So if you think you understand a system and you think you know exactly what levers to pull in order to manipulate that system, you'll be more likely to sort of take a chance because you figure, ah, it doesn't matter, I know what I'm doing. Whereas if you accept uncertainty and if you accept that there's this incredibly complex world out there, you know, what you call the global enduring disorder, it's this kind of area where you start to think like, maybe we don't understand this. Maybe we shouldn't involve ourselves in a sort of policy that might blow up in our faces. And I think what I'm arguing as well is that I think we've become more prone to flukes over the last several decades because all of the policymaking that we're told is the good stuff is about optimization and efficiency. It's about the squeezing out these like bits of slack from our social systems. But the slack is what produces resilience. When you think about the Suez Canal being blocked and like $50 billion of economic damage from this one boat in the Suez Canal, that's a system that's not resilient, right? A single boat can cause an economic meltdown globally. And we're better off, in my view, accepting the limits of our understanding, embracing the complexity and understanding that it's really, really complicated, and therefore having less hubris about manipulating and controlling systems that we fundamentally cannot control.
Yes, and I would argue that a European way of looking at things is closer to that than a North American or kind of neo-East Asian tiger way. And you talk about this in your book, which is that there's a people who, you know, when they want to determine how they plant the rice, they consult some omens. But the omens actually just randomize where they plant the rice. And as a result, they don't have famine as much because they've just planted the rice randomly. Whereas if you're hubristic and you're like, aha, given this factor, we should put our rice here. And then all of a sudden it doesn't rain there and you're scrod. And there's no reason to plant Merlot in Burgundy. The Pinot Noir has been working there and you don't need to optimize for it. There are historical things going on, and far be it from us. You know, if the monks had been doing it for 1,000 years, why are we going to change it?
Yeah, so this is, and since you're a sports fan, I know you like this stuff, but this is where I say, like, you need to figure out which problems are Moneyball problems and which ones are not.
Yes.
For those who haven't come across Moneyball, Michael Lewis writes this book about it. It becomes a film with Brad Pitt. And it's basically how data analytics revolutionized baseball because it turned out to be very, very effective at coming up with strategies that the coaches, based on their intuition, hadn't thought of, right? Now, a lot of people learned the wrong lesson from that film. The lesson they learned was, like, we should just use analytics for everything. And the problem is that baseball is, or sports in general, are super different from the world because they're closed systems in which there are basically two, or if you're European, three possible outcomes if you can have ties, right? There's like basically three outcomes. In the economy, there are more than three outcomes, right? There's also like an infinite number of players, whereas in a sport, there's like a specific number of players that can be on the field. There's rules, and those rules are intact year to year. It's the same exact system. So data analytics works really, really well on problems that are closed systems with very clearly defined rules and the same players and a finite number of outcomes. Geopolitics is the polar opposite of a baseball game. It's the polar opposite of a football game. It's where people are breaking the rules constantly. There are new entrants to the game all the time. There's an infinite number of possible outcomes. And so I think, you know, the problem is that you start to get into real, real difficulties with hubris when you basically treat the world as though you can moneyball it. And there are parts of the world that are moneyballable. Like if you're trying to work in a health system, if you're trying to figure out how to like get the best bang for your buck in the NHS, like, yeah, it's probably a good idea to moneyball things because it's a relatively closed system. It's not quite the same as a football game, but we think the NHS is not going to suddenly train clowns. We know that there's certain outcomes that it's not going to do. So the degree to which the system is predictable, closed, and has rules and so on is the degree to which the data analytics can predict things. And geopolitics in the global enduring disorder is the most unimaginably non-moneyball problem that could possibly exist, right? Because the data is less and less predictive from the past of what's going to happen in the future.
Maybe you could tell us about how looking at physics and biology and stuff has given you some metaphors or different insights into geopolitics.
Yeah, I mean, I think this was the revelation I've had in the last sort of 5 years of my professional life is that all the incentives are to get narrower and narrower expertise when we're actually dealing with similar problems from totally different contexts, right? I mean, evolutionary biologists are trying to figure out why is it that a squid looks the way it does? And it's a historic question. And so they're trying to trace causality the same way that we're trying to figure out why is it that Trump emerged? But they're having totally different frameworks and so on. And I think mixing and matching them can be really helpful in sort of germinating new kinds of thinking. It's very easy in all of these fields because of our mastery of physics. We have incredible tools to predict systems in ways that were just, you know, they would have been deemed wizardry in the past. And in geopolitics, it's the same sort of dynamic where on the day-to-day basis, we have highly, highly predictable systems, right? I mean, we feel in control more than I think probably humans have ever felt. I think, you know, the paradox of this moment that I see is that you have more order in the sort of controllable systems of daily life than probably ever before, and AI is only going to increase that, at the same time that the superstructure of the world is becoming more and more disordered.
And we all know this emotionally. When I read that point in the book, I was like, I have known this. Brian has distilled it. And what I would say to listeners, Fluke distills a lot of what we kind of already know about how the world has felt different in the last 10 or so years than maybe how we were growing up.
Yeah, and I think, you know, this is the kind of stuff where when you think that way, I think that's the dangerous recipe, right? Because I think there's like an aspect of modern life where people think that science is more or less on mop-up duty, like that we're sort of just dealing with the niggling problems that still exist. Yes. And I think this is true for politics too. It's like, oh yes, like, oh, there was that recession, but now we've learned from it and now we won't have it again. And like, there's a widespread view that I think is totally wrong that we sort of have figured it out.
100%. 100%.
And I think people in Britain, for example, are, you know, part of the reason why the Tories are in trouble in the election is because it's become so apparent that that's not true. And that juxtaposition between this sort of ethos of like, oh, we're the masters of our own destiny. We're in the 21st century. We can do incredible things, which is true, at the same time that like basic stuff is broken.
This gets back to why I got into this field. I remember when I was first in Israel in 2000, 2001, and the Second Intifada had started. I had been studying biology and chemistry in Massachusetts. And I was like, Jesus Christ, the problem isn't with inventing like a new cancer drug, it's in distributing the ones that we already do have. And when you think about these, obviously the horrible famine and tragedy that's happening in Gaza, it isn't that the West doesn't have the ability to help people. And it isn't even that the Israeli army doesn't have the logistical capacity to like take some people out of the areas that they're bombing and whatever. It's that they don't for a whole range of complicated reasons. And we do have the ability to deliver so many better outcomes for people, even in non-war zones, in, you know, the underprivileged areas in Iowa and Northern England and whatever, but we don't for a range of policy failures. I find that so heartbreaking, Brian, that when you get your head into that, for me, I get kind of angry at our leaders who are not willing to shake things up enough to reinvent how we do this.
I agree with you completely. And I think there's a lot of stuff that's on autopilot, both in geopolitics and domestic politics. We're like, if you think about politics and what we actually do to solve problems, we basically line up two sides. If it's a proportional system, maybe there's three or four sides, whatever. And they each sort of say, like, here's how we're going to fix the problem. And then one of them wins. And then we do that for like 5 years. And then we do another election, right? What we do is we basically say, here's our intervention. And then like 5 years later, we either vote for it or we vote against it. Now, even when an intervention succeeds, there could have been something better. But we don't know because we've never tested it, right? So one of the arguments that I'm basically making is that if you have uncertainty in geopolitics, in politics domestically, in economics, whatever it is, the thing to do is to experiment. It's to figure out what works. And I think there's a lot of people who pontificate the way that, you know, social scientists and pundits do. And the real answer is most of us don't know. We don't know what's the best thing. And I think that like that is something where this is a moment where experimentation is more deserving than ever. I mean, you think about what you were just talking about in Northern England or distribution in rural America and so on. I mean, we have this revolution in the ability to work remotely. It's the first time in human history you don't have to work where you live, probably, right? What are we doing about it? Nothing. I mean, there's no urban experimentation. There's no ideas like what could we do to make this something that creates new types of growth. And the opportunity of the disorder is the experimentation. It's like, okay, things are falling apart. Now is the time to actually try something different. And yet, you know, this is when we're so locked into ideological divides and so on.
You draw extensively in Fluke on how human sensory perception confronts reality, and there is a degree of mismatch. And you don't use the word existentialism in Fluke, but I saw it as a deeply existentialist text. You say that we have a desire as humans to tell stories, to create spirituality, to have heuristics and understand things. But then there's this unbelievably chaotic world where a tipping point is reached and there was a fluke. And I'm reading your book and I'm like, we just have to have the modesty to understand that what's happening out there, it's going to create all sorts of things like, ah, the migrants took my job, or blame it all on people who have a different skin color than me, because we need to have some kind of story, and you cannot understand the complexity of why you're experiencing a given thing.
Yeah, so the two things I'd say about that, one of them is that superstition is basically this impulse, right? And for a long time, it was also religion in intellectual history, where it's like, you have this crazy disordered world, how do we fit it all together? Well, there's something that's behind it, right? That's the impulse for God. And then with superstition, it's like, well, I don't know how to control any of these crazy things that are happening to me, so I'll have an amulet that hopefully will protect me. And you see this in the rates of superstition and witchcraft belief and so on are often correlated with the degree to which very unusual, upsetting things happen to people, which is why they're often, you know, now so strongly correlated in the global South and so on, where calamities befall people all the time. But I also think, you know, one of the things that I would say about just riffing on was this issue of the sort of simple answers to complex questions. And this is where populism has arrived at the worst possible time. What 100%. Populists do is they tell you that they will fix everything, and they tell you a very simple story about who's to blame, and then they don't fix everything. They actually make it much worse. And they're doing it at a moment where the complexity of the world is so great that the damage they inflict has cascading effects in a way that would have been compartmentalized 50 years ago, right? And that's the issue. I mean, it's the worst possible moment for all these things to happen because it is an extremely volatile period of immense change in a short period of time.
To highlight something there, it's the human desire for order. And this is why I see you as an existentialist, because people really want to believe in order. They want to believe that if you're good in your life, good things will happen to you. And if you treat other people nicely, you will be treated nicely and you'll go to the good place. This desire for order and justice is one of the key things that makes us human. And I think that you're onto something key there. However, I have one slight distinction or disagreement in how you present things in the book. When you write, we tend to systematically downplay the role of luck, the word we use to describe the random and accidentally intersecting with our lives. Consider the widespread but mistaken belief that the global super rich must have earned their wealth due to their genius. I'm going to contend that very few people really believe that anymore. Those people are a dying breed, and that contemporary post-America dream society and post-Thatcherite Britain is very rooted in exactly the ideas of contingency that you and I actually both believe, that this idea of I'm master of my own destiny or wealth gospel, or that a given tech mogul is rich because he happened to be a genius at computers, that is like antiquated mid-20th century thinking.
Yeah, I mean, so I totally take your point. I think the way I would describe this is I would say that everybody in their own individual life that I've spoken to about the book has said, oh yes, let me tell you the fluke that changed everything for me. So it's not something that they've never thought about, right? I'm not suggesting that they think, oh, this is all ordered and structured and that I'm in control of everything. They all understand the role of chance. I think the difference is that I think society runs on the myth. You can have lots of individual people who don't believe that this sort of stuff is where you're the master of your destiny. But I think, you know, if you look at like the discourse in Republican Party politics, the myth is very much alive and well. Like, I think that there are individual people who, if you ask them, you know, how did you end up buying your farm? They would accept that there are things that were out of their control, either that they benefited from or that they were harmed by in that process on an individual level. But then when you say things about how society operates, you say, well, why didn't they just deal with this problem and choose to be better, right? And so I think there's, and this is the same juxtaposition between lived experience and modeling. So lived experience, it's the exact reason why, you know, qualitative researchers, historians, anthropologists, and so on, all of them completely appreciate the role of the small stuff. They see it. It's like so obvious. When I go and do field work, it's so obvious that these little details of personality traits, whatever, matter. But then when we have to systematize things, we smooth that all out and we say, oh, it's all about the order. It's all about these sorts of things that were supposed to happen or whatever. What I would say that's interesting about what you're critiquing in terms of the American dream and so on, which I still think is alive and kicking for a lot of people in terms of this idea that, like, if you just work hard, things will work out for you.
I think among the young, not so much.
I take that point, but I still think there's a lot of people who do believe it. But what I would say is, interestingly, I had a great conversation with someone who is devoutly religious about the ideas in the book, because they said that they completely accepted that they were not in control because God was. And what was really interesting was that it was sort of a horseshoe theory. I personally am not a believer, and I'm looking at this from a scientific perspective of chaos theory. He was looking at it from the perspective of God controlling everything and working in totally mysterious ways. But the end result was the same. It was like, yeah, I'm not in charge. And so there's this sort of strange juxtaposition between that the religious right in the US has this idea around the American dream still being alive for a certain segment of the Republican Party and so on. And like, you know, mastery of your own destiny, pick yourself up from your bootstraps and so on. But also like this sort of view that God decides everything. And there's a tension there, right? But, you know, I think there is something where I completely agree with you that there are structural forces that are so obvious to us that we know that it's not purely up to us in terms of how we are determined. But when I get asked questions about the book, I mean, often people will say, like, does this mean we can't deserve our success? And that's a deeply unsettling thing, even to people who are taking, you know, this viewpoint that you suggest, that some things are out of our control. And I'm like, yeah, like, there's a lot of stuff I didn't choose that is probably the biggest factors in my life. You know, like where I was born, when I was born, who my parents were, how my brain was structured, all these sorts of things. And so I think at the same time that you're right that there's a downgrading of this myth, most of our society runs on the idea that people get what they deserve, and therefore that this is something where you should claim credit when you succeed and you should take blame when you fail. I still think that's a dominant part of the cultural narrative. I will accept it's diminished relative to the way that people talked about pulling themselves up from their bootstraps in the 1960s compared to today.
I agree that some of those Thatcherite and Reaganite myths do persist in our society. 100% accept that. I want to say that the idea, your idea stands on its own merits and doesn't need to have the straw manning of correcting common misconceptions, because many people may parrot a Thatcherite or Reaganite myth about you get what you deserve, and if you really work hard, you can make money or whatever, but they actually don't believe it. So I think that there's something else going on here, and that it's that they don't believe it, which may have led to the rise of neo-populism, both in the UK and US, because the certitudes that have underlied the American dream or the Thatcherite, neoliberal British dream, shall we say, I believe have really come undone in an emotional level and have left people floundering.
The one pushback I'd have on that is like the self-help industry is basically this. The self-help industry is basically saying, if you just do these things, you will succeed in life. And like the incredibly lucrative world of manifesting, for example, which is now about how you conjure wealth to you, or the success of The Secret, right? One of the best-selling books of the 20th century. These are the kinds of things where when you think about them, the underlying message is effectively, if you just do these things, you will be rich and successful and you'll get out of poverty. It's the antithesis to the structural argument, right? And like these industries are enormous. They are like, if you look on the New York Times bestseller list, it's just full of these books that tell you you're the master and, you know, if you just do these things, you'll be fine.
And after the break, is it good to have some disorder in our personal lives?
The holidays have arrived early with Blinds.com's Spring Black Friday sale. Upgrading window coverings can be a minor project with a major impact. Blinds.com makes it easy and affordable. Browse premium blinds, shades, shutters. We have your patio covered too. And get unlimited window treatments installed for one low cost. Free shipping and Blinds.com's 100% satisfaction guarantee. Shop Blinds.com's Spring Black Friday sale now. Save up to 45% plus premium doorbusters. Up to 45% off at Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
This episode is brought to you by Etsy. Looking to instantly upgrade your Mother's Day gift from typical to meaningful? Shop Etsy. Now until May 12th, get up to 30% off personalized jewelry, style, decor, and so many other items mom will love. And if you want her to know you put a ton of thought into her present, use Gift Mode. Gift Mode on Etsy takes the stress out of gifting so you can easily find well-crafted, original, and affordable pieces from small shops. Just tap or click Gift Mode on your Etsy app or Etsy.com. Then answer a few short questions about mom, and Gift Mode instantly gives you curated ideas based on hundreds of personas. Need something original and affordable for Mother's Day? Etsy has it. Shop until May 12th for up to 30% off gifts for mom. Terms apply.
So this is the Disorder Show, and I'm going to say that I believe order is a spiritual virtue, and wanting to cultivate order in our personal lives as well as in our geopolitical lives is not about, oh, if we do these few ordered things, or we have this ordered international system, we're going to be wealthier or we're going to have greater life expectancy. No, it is a spiritual virtue.
I think it's an evolved virtue. I think it's something that basically, if you don't understand basic patterns of cause and effect in the sort of deep past of human history, you're more likely to die. And so I think there's something where trying to understand a very clear X causes Y pattern is something that evolved as an impulse for us. Now, I think that you're right in the sense that the dissociation between the sort of discussion of order as a good thing and the consequence is an important one, because I actually think a fully ordered world, not on the geopolitics side, right, but on the personal side, a fully ordered, predictable, rational, controllable world would be a terrible place to live in. I mean, I think almost all of the things that are enjoyable in our personal lives are serendipity-based. The chaos of life is sometimes really vibrant and exciting. For me, I think there's a huge degree to which that's true. I think that there's a lot of stuff. Okay, if you're talking about cancer diagnoses, uncertainty is terrible. If you're talking about the sort of understanding of exactly how your life is going to unfold, I mean, if I could read a book when I was 6 years old that says this is what's going to happen in your life, I would find that unbelievably dystopian.
Yeah, so I think whether you find Aldous Huxley's Brave New World and the scenario sketch there where there's tremendous sexual gratification and there's your material and economic needs taken care of, but things are predictable and you can't access great art and stuff. If your life is really worked out quite well and chances have been not only intellectually stimulating but fun and have not had a huge amount of risk, you're more likely to see that kind of insane order and control as dystopian. But if you've been suffering at either at the subsistence level or you've had a lot of tragic things happen to you, you're likely to find that quite utopian. So For me, I feel like I've had a lot of suffering through chance, whether it's being kidnapped and tortured in Syria, to my recent ACL injury, to the complete nightmare I've had with my contractors. I have always been someone who thinks that having some order in one's personal life and geopolitics would be good, rather than where we are at as a society, because I'm so deeply worried about where we are.
Yeah, I mean, for me, we agree on the geopolitics probably, but we disagree on the personal side of things. I mean, I think for me, it's something where there's a line I have where I say something to the effect of, like, if you were given a probability spreadsheet of who you're going to marry, you know, when you're like 15 years old, and it's like a 66% chance of person A and a 12% chance of person B and so on. I think that stuff eliminates a lot of what is joyful about life. I think the sort of uncertainty and the chaos where a random conversation can lead to a spouse or a random encounter can lead to a job and these sorts of things. It's also, you know, even when we plan things, often what we remember the most is the uncertain stuff, the unpredictable stuff. I think there are parts of the world in which what's good for our own lives is also good for society and geopolitics. And I think this is one area where I like the chaos and disorder in some parts of my life. It's the sort of classic example of the Apollonian and Dionysian sides of humans, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yes.
There's the order and there's the partying in Dionysus, and that's the uncertainty and so on. And you need both of them. Like, if you had a fully scripted, structured life that had no surprise for an individual and no serendipity, I think it would be bleak. And I think if you had exclusively disorder, everything would be terrible. So it's about balancing them in the right ways. And I think what you're talking about on the geopolitics side has gone far too much towards the Dionysian, and we'd be much better off with a little bit of Apollo. Whereas I actually think in our day-to-day lives, I think a lot of people's social angst is from the checklist existence. I think it's from the sort of everything is optimized, you have a schedule. I think there's a lot of people who are trying to escape that world because it has too much predictability, certainty, and so on.
In an ordered world where you have your routines and you are more likely to have your basic pyramid of needs met, I think then you can cultivate the interesting uncertainty of playing games of chance and enjoying them and watching sports, because it's not like there isn't going to be interesting coincidences there. And, you know, you never know how a given book is going to touch you or something new that you can explore with your partner. I mean, I don't think that those things are the antithesis of order, but it's the huge existential risk that we face of being hit by a car, outbreaks of racism and hatred and Islamophobia and anti-Semitism and the collapse of our democracy. I feel that there's just too much of that in the personal, like I might lose my life savings because I invested in this stock and whatever, that we're surrounded in a world with way too few guardrails. From my perspective,
most of the things you're talking about are outgrowths of a society that's dysfunctional as opposed to a lifestyle. So what I'm saying is that I think that in the structural aspects of society, you want everything to run predictably. You'd much rather not have financial shocks and pandemics and all these sorts of things that upend your life. You'd have that all smoothed out and relatively predictable in a relatively ordered way. But I think that a lot of us in our day-to-day lives live overly indexed lives to things that I call a checklist existence. I mean, this is my—
I've never met those people.
Well, I'm definitely one of them. I mean, I think that I've lived a life in which there's an endless set of goals that give rise to another set of goals. And I think like a lot of the happiest moments are when I just totally sever that and just go camping for 4 days. You know what I mean? Where it's like, I'm just disappearing from the world. I'm going to sort of just hike somewhere. And I think there's a huge number of people. This is why you have like the rise of the tech billionaires who are trying to go on like guru-based retreats to basically experience what it was like before our lives were so scripted, where they're trying to do psychedelics or they're trying to sort of get a taste of the original kind of humanity. And I think it's because we've lost a bit of that, a little bit of the serendipity. So it's more on the day-to-day stuff. It's not about your basic needs. It's about the, do I want to live a world where like my Google Calendar dictates how I live my life as opposed to spontaneity and exploration and all those things. And I think that our group of people is further down the sort of Google Calendar side than anyone who's ever lived, basically.
Let's order the disorder. And orderers out there, there are so many lessons from Fluke about how we can make the world a better place. And these are lessons for policymakers. So I want to hear from Brian. As you were doing the research, writing the book, talking to like really smart biologists and tech people, what were your takeaways? You know, how should we order the disorder?
So my number one takeaway is to focus on resilience rather than optimization to the absolute limit. I mean, this is the thing where I think when you hear a politician talk or when you hear a policymaker propose an idea, almost all the time it's about efficiency gains, optimization, eliminating waste, and so on. All those things are good until they get to a tipping point where they create brittleness in a system. So if you optimize the absolute limit of a system, you create fragility. And I don't hear a lot of people talking about planning for catastrophe, which is basically what I think a lot of our system requires. I think that there's so much where we don't learn the lessons of the past, we just move on to the next crisis. And one of my favorite examples of this, I have to be careful about how I word this because I don't want people to think that I'm putting my lot in with conspiracy theorists and so on, but there is debate about the origins of COVID-19, right? It is theoretically possible for a lab leak to occur. Whether it occurred for COVID-19 or not, we don't know. But when I looked into this, I'm like, okay, so I'm researching all these like biosecurity level 4 labs and all these places where extremely dangerous pathogens exist. And there is no international oversight of these places. None.
100%.
It is unbelievable. And it's like one of these things where even if COVID didn't start in a lab, another pandemic absolutely could. And what we do is we sort of just like, oh, the pandemic is over. Now let's move on. And I think if you have an appreciation for chaos theory in social systems, you spend a lot more time thinking about the contingencies of how do we prepare for disaster. And I just think like, you know, there's a sort of way of thinking about the world where we have 4% growth every year, but every 15 years, there's a financial meltdown. That's option A. Or we have 2.5% growth every year, and there's never a financial meltdown. And I think obviously I'm making up sort of fake scenarios, but I'm saying that if you had the choice, you should pick option B because there's so many things that get wiped out.
This is the exact flow with neoliberalism. One of the things we're railing about on this podcast is that the neoliberalism is going to have periods of more growth, but then it is by its very nature going to lead to uncontrollable fluke and black swan events because it takes away what I call state capacity. Our leaders from Thatcher and Reagan onward said, we want to outsource state capacity. We don't believe in cultivating state capacity. Well, what do you know? The Chinese and the Russians and others did believe in having state capacity. And therefore, we may have outgained them in our semiconductor innovation, but we're not able to control the implications of all these semiconductors. So tell us about the implications of this lack of slack in our societies. You referenced it a few times. We seem to be in the position of the NFL team who has only one kicker and one reasonable quarterback. The problem is that if the kicker pulls his hamstring, and quarterbacks, of course, they get hit all the time, the chances of the team winning go to almost zero because you can't win without your star quarterback. Essentially, I have heard that in the UK, it was forbidden to study by the government implications of negative Brexit scenarios, that they were not allowed to do scenario planning. This is where we are globally. We're in a situation where we make a rule that it's not allowed to study exactly those key scenarios that we might find ourselves in until we plummet into the abyss.
The problem is that our political systems, and this is something that's a deeper problem with the media space, the way politics works and so on, is that you never get any accolades for good planning, right? You get accolades for delivering results in the short term, especially in democracies in extremely capitalist systems. And I think this is the kind of stuff where like we have to find a way to praise and reward politicians who have set us up to be resilient. There's a great example from this, I think it's from the work of Duncan Watts, where he's talking about how when you look at Hollywood executives, and there's this classic case, I forget the name of the CEO, where the CEO comes in at a failing studio, and everything turns around and all the blockbusters come out and they make hundreds of millions of dollars. And it turns out you analyze it and the CEO who got fired was the one who greenlighted all the projects and they had inherited the ones before them, right? And it's like, this is the kind of stuff we have in politics. It's where whatever happens during the time you're in office, you get the credit or the blame for. And if you actually prepare for 10 years or 15 years down the road with resilience, it's your opponent who's going to get all the credit. So we've designed systems that I think create disincentives for long-term planning for resilience, which is a huge, huge danger to modern society.
100%. And this is why we need consensus politics. So, Brian, thank you for ordering The Disorder with me. And I think that the lessons from your book, Fluke, really get at how thinking about order and disorder in our personal lives and geopolitics is so critical for understanding, you know, where we're at in the world today and how we got here. So I couldn't recommend this, you know, book more highly.
Thank you for having me on the show.
I don't know if we've ordered or disordered the world this week. It's probably too chaotic and there are too many flukes out there for me to know how this episode will affect you. If you enjoyed these musings, please follow us wherever you listen to this podcast. And also check out our Substack. The link is in the show notes. And most critically, I really suggest that you try to get your hands on Brian's new book, Fluke. Happy 6-month anniversary, orderers. It's been quite enjoyable to celebrate it with you. For the key people who have helped us celebrate together, our producer has been, as always, George McDonough. And our executive producer is Neil Fern. Alex has been helping behind the scenes, but is away this week. Thank you, Alex. And thank you for listening.